We all tell ourselves stories of who we are and why. But we forget that we have the power to define them. That no idea grows from mewling striped cub to teeth at your throat tiger without a little help, some guidance, and a whole lot of love along the way. I'm Jared Cerf, and this is Here Be Tigers. Hi all, I'm Jared Cerf, and this is Here Be Tigers, your storytelling guide. Here with me today is...
It's Ken again.
Back with more wonderful, spectacular ideas, I presume.
I am currently trying to come up with some ideas, actually, which is sort of the point of this exercise.
You had proposed a notion a while back, I believe, of something we've done for years, but now in a more, I suppose, codified fashion, where you message me with, I need to create a thing, and we spend 2 hours coming up with what it is.
Well, kinda. I mean, a thing that I have not heard anybody do is try to document the process of actually writing what boils down to an adventure.
Now, this is for role-playing games, right? Tabletop or online?
Yeah, I mean, currently, because I'm running a game of it, my head is in very much in the Pathfinder 2nd Edition mode. But honestly, a good module really doesn't need a ton of, I'm going to say, thought, right, to bring over to another system. The stat blocks for things are the hard part. But the, oh, yeah, no, there could totally be a forbidden temple on this, you know, ice moon or whatever
right.
process in a sci-fi game is okay.
What you're talking about is a story seed, something someone can take a look at and go, oh, I know my readers, my players would love to engage in this kind of narrative.
Well, I mean, I am and I'm not. So what I want to do, honestly, is sit here and develop an adventure and kind of document the thought process and the effort that gets into it. Not like every single
nook and cranny of it.
Thought, right? But you start from story seeds, but then you actually have to make them particular. And it's the making them particular part I haven't heard anybody do a good job of explaining.
What do you think makes a module in particular a different kind of story or story premise than, say, just a prompt or a collection of possibilities?
If you read a good kind of open-ended module, and here I'm thinking of things like The Dark of Hot Springs Island or Desert Moon of Karth, all right? Things that I know I have encountered lately that have impressed me, okay? Mm-hmm. A lot of them are very open-ended. You know, The Hot Springs Island definitely doesn't even have a story. It's a hex crawl setup. It's a very elaborate one. Or I had read another thing that I have now forgotten the name of by the folks who did it that was a lot less ambitious, which was literally just the tomb of an unhappy wizard guy.
In other words, it's less about setting up the story than it is the world and the characters in this place and letting you, the group, decide how you would like to engage with them.
Fundamentally, I think it's about environments and challenges. Those are the two kind of umbrella terms I'd want to use.
You reminded me of a moment, I think, from way back during the 4E days, Dungeons and Dragons, which had, for those of you who are not familiar with the system, divided challenges into combat and skill, and you participated in one or the other using different abilities. Well, the reason I bring it up is that it created this mentality where the streams did not cross. You were either in combat or a skill challenge.
Right, and the way 4th edition was put together, that made sense. Honestly, just the combat was such a dominant part of 4th edition because so much paper and thought was taken up on getting it done that made sense. But in most cases, even for a fairly crunchy game, it's better to think of things as environments where things are happening, okay? And things that are challenging people in those environments.
Right. Whether they are intelligent or sentient or not, they have a motive. And if they are intelligent, there are motives and desires and things they wish to accomplish that you can either satisfy or get in the way of.
Well, and you can go deep on that or not, right? I mean, like, if you posit that a challenge is a pack of wolves, that's not a challenge with, like, a huge amount of branching options, and that's okay. In fact, in some ways, that's better when you're trying to write something, because the fewer possible solutions, okay, the harder it is for you to go wrong in anticipating where your players are going with it.
one of the two moments, I think, in the old Academy World game early on that I most terrified the players, not just in terms of the narrative description, but in terms of their limited options. So the core premise I had for the setting is that we would take fantasy things and give them a not corrupted, but an altered twist. They weren't what they used to be. Nothing could be as it was as a fantasy trope. And at one point, I knew they were going into this place called the Weir, which is at the forest and then the murk beyond it, which is a horrifying swamp. I started looking to, okay, what are the kinds of critters that dwell within the woods? And I saw stick bugs, and then I thought, you know, I can take this further. Let's do it with spiders. And I narrated them crossing this bridge that had a horrifying, strange kind of texture to it that seemed to shift occasionally. But they were deeply preoccupied, and it wasn't until halfway through their crossing of the bridge that they realized the entire thing was spiders.
Right. Or when we started playing Abomination Vaults last week.
Right.
And you guys got to where the adventure happens and immediately were like, okay, so what do we see? Mm-hmm. And the two important things you saw, for all intents and purposes, were a rickety bridge that went inside the keep and a dock. And so you were stuck on that for a couple minutes, insisting on making checks to see if you had seen anything interesting at the dock. And finally, since I had, you know, prepared myself a little bit, and you guys were determined to roll, I fed you, yeah, you see a rowboat at the dock. And that's there. That's in the adventure, by the way.
Sure.
It's not mentioned until the dock, which is like 20 items into that area. But screw it. You guys were looking around outside. You could see the rowboat. That's fine. You know?
Part of this is that you don't know what details in a narrative premise are going to be intriguing to the characters that arrive.
Right.
The reason I gave them the bridge was to foreshadow that this was not the challenge. You cross past the bridge, you escape it, you're safe.
Right.
This was the foreshadowing for the nest they were going to go into.
Sure. There's a bridge and here, but also the bridge is creepy. So
eventually they managed to get deep enough into the woods and they disturbed the nest. And then it became less of, oh, let's explore, and more of run. And how can we run, and who runs and who doesn't, and who trips and falls. The components were much smaller and more specific.
And for a lot of games that don't prioritize combat, is how I'm going to phrase this, run becomes a pretty viable option in these situations if you set up a challenge appropriately, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a different thing to think about a situation where you actually expect the players to fight stuff. Right?
But where the core assumption is, how are they going to kill it and take its stuff?
Well, or not even... No, that's not the core assumption, actually. That's a goal that the players have.
Usually.
Okay. The core assumption is, what can I put here that is interesting for them to try to do that to?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What makes sense to have living here? Because if you put a cyborg in the middle of some kind of, I don't know, hedge maze, right? That's just going to raise more questions. Why is there a cyborg in the hedge maze? Why isn't it some kind of evil gardener or something, you know?
What kind of hedges are there that would necessitate a giant robot to...
Right. And if you're trying to pre-write things, you don't actually want to go down the infinite question trail all that far.
Right. There's a certain amount of space you want to leave, or truths you want to leave open to interpretation or to filling in.
Well, yes, but also you don't want to create a situation where... What happens is every detail that comes out of your mouth makes people keep asking more questions. Okay.
Right, because then you destroy the pacing.
Right. As your listeners may know, because I think I've mentioned it before, I have been playing a lot of the Cephalofare games, Gloomhaven, Frosthaven series. All right. I was a backer for the first release for Gloomhaven. We were among the first people who got Frosthaven sent to us in my little group there. We've been playing a lot of that. The game involves going to places and doing missions in a very fourth edition Dungeons and Dragons sort of way, right? But in between, as you're on the road to those places, and when you come back, there are event cards that you resolve. And the event cards are nearly always a choose A or B situation, right? And they are so easy to overthink sometimes.
Are they generally all terrible?
A lot of the road cards in Gloomhaven were basically going to be bad no matter what you chose. Frosthaven has improved on that somewhat. There is usually a right choice in Frosthaven if you think about it.
Right, but there's a certain... I recall this from our early days of either running board games or playing various role-playing games, where the moment where a big choice should be made quickly, and then you're eager and ready and everyone wants to dive into the action, becomes this slog of, well, What are we going to do?
Right. Well, what do we do now? Shit. That could be this, 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 or this. This could be that, that, or that. And that's good at the right moment.
It's good, and, too, if it's the kind of fun the group wants to have.
Well, it's not even that. Like, what are we going to do here is great.
Sure.
At the end of an adventure, mm-hmm. right? It's terrible 30 minutes into the session while everybody's still eating chips and stuff, and then suddenly you stop.
You encounter Slime Lord the Imperiler. Great. I am going to roll history for his title and lineage.
Slime Lord the Imperiler was almost the most straightforward challenge I had presented you guys in a while, and I'm still amazed you managed to get yourselves killed.
Not just killed thoroughly.
Like, completely killed. This was a total party kill back in our third edition days.
Oh.
And I presented them with an underground ziggurat overflowing with slime with a bunch of creepy plants on it, and they proceeded to split up and try to invade it from three different places at once.
What fascinates me most about that moment is you likewise, as we've talked about on the show, presented us with the door leading to the pillars in the lava with snakes coiling, with fiery snakes coiling about that.
It was immediately after they noped out of that, to be clear, listeners. They were like, we don't want to do that. But the ziggurat covered in slime, they were all in for. They're like, yeah, this is probably fine. We're going to be good here.
Well, you see the difference. The fundamental difference is you can keep treasure in the ziggurat.
You could have kept treasure in the lair of the lava serpent. It would have been
who's
fine.
Who's going in?
The lava serpent.
We should have tamed them instead, obviously.
I am no longer capable of... I may not even have actually written stats for the damn thing, to be honest. It was meant to scare you.
Well.
But, you know, I can no longer really tell you what could have come of that, is what I'm going to go with. You were so close to me running out of things that I could throw at you that weren't the boss of that dungeon, too, after like a year and a half, almost 2 years.
And we settled it upon the evil wizard, Foozle.
Well, him you beat, barely.
Right.
After a fun preliminary encounter where he came after you guys and you ran him off. And I thought that was really, really rad. I thought that was a fun sort of emergent event. You were like, well, fuck that guy. We're going to go get him.
Well, and that's part of it, too. So much of what follows from the base premise occurs in the game, playing the threads that lay out there. Once you see what characters hook into, what they find interesting, or in this case, the vendettas they create.
Right. So to go back to the environments and challenges thing, an environment shouldn't be static and a challenge should be reactive.
You know, it's fascinating. One of the things I found myself teaching a couple of years ago frequently, particularly as people were writing their stories, was that the background does not have to remain so.
Yes. So if I posit that my environment for this, let's go back to the hedge maze, because we already threw that out there, right? Sure. This is a spooky hedge maze. That's my environment. Mm-hmm. So people are going to get lost in there. You know this because the word maze is in the name of the environment.
It's the nature of this environment. They will be
right. Lost. Some plant stuff is going to go down. The hedge maze is probably attached to some sort of building because that's where you find hedge mazes. They're not just out there in a field somewhere.
Unless it's some type of horrifying cornrow hedge mage, and then the question is, why are you there?
Yes. So there are other ways you could go with this, but let's assume, again, for the purposes of this exercise, that we are playing the hedge maze more or less straight. Mm-hmm. The players are probably trying to get into or out of the building at the end of the hedge maze, because that's sort of the purpose of a hedge maze, right?
You know what'd be glorious? Let's say there's, you know, a fancy manor in town and the group is a bunch of thieves that wants to break in and steal something rightfully or wrongly.
Yeah, sure.
And they've scouted the whole place out. It's got the gardens. It's got the big road leading up front where the carriages can circle around.
Right.
Nowhere on the premises do they find a hedge maze. They find topiary, right? All other kinds of signs that this person loves their property and keeps it. But it's only when they leave that they're in the maze.
Right. And this would be a great thing to do in a Blades in the Dark game, for example. You could let them finish stealing whatever they came into and then ask them to tell you how they're leaving and then tell them, yeah, you're in a hedge maze. At which point, because it's the nature of Blades in the Dark, things are going to escalate really quickly and your players are going to start doing weird stuff.
Right, because there's an undercurrent, despite that being about being the rogues gallery there, that the world is...
The world of Blades in the Dark is both spooky and a little bit of a liminal space. Weird stuff could happen anytime.
So the fact that suddenly when you escape this, and I think that the eeriest part here is, let's say they broke in, there's nothing beyond the usual means to prevent them from
Right. They've done a normal, like, mansion robbery for whatever reason, which in Blades in the Dark probably includes having to shoot some guys or, you know, poison some dogs or things like that.
then they find that as they escape that the maze is the real defense.
Right. That's the real adventure. Everybody's really confused and we're done in the mansion in about an hour.
That's where you change the tone too, because there's the caper, which has a conclusion. We got the goods. Now we escape. And I think this is particularly fun if you've given them other flavors of caper before. You've had whole protracted ones. And now, to your point, this time they have the caper, it's done quickly, and then the game is the escape.
If the point of the hedge maze is to be spooky, the best way to deploy that is after several missions where nothing that spooky happened, because otherwise people will be keyed up for it. And so this gets back to challenges should be dynamic. I don't necessarily mean in and of themselves, but among the whole set of challenges that you have, they should be dynamic.
Yes. So there's twofold here. One, you have to consider, if you're writing a series, where this could potentially sit within the series. But if it's a standalone opportunity, a standalone module,
right,
then you might want to leave a suggestion at the beginning saying, hey, this is best used after.
Right. Or this could connect to this, right? So, for example, all right, the three ideas I wrote down prior to you and I starting to talk about this the other night were basically just environments. I wrote down abandoned gemstone mine, mysterious island, and graveyard.
Which are good foundations. Those are all terrible places to be.
Right. And I took each of those except the mysterious island, because mysterious islands can go so many ways that you almost can't start with one.
No, I think we at one point we started teasing out, okay, what would be acts 1, 2, and 3? And the islands had to at least be act 3.
It's not possible for the island to be act 1. It's probably not possible for the island to be act 2, unless the island is the setting of the entire scenario.
In which case, you have an island with graveyards and gemstone mines and man's places.
Right. But then the island is no longer an environment. It's sort of an overarching consideration for the other environments.
Right.
And that's fine. Sure. That's not wrong. It's just not how I had been looking at things. So, and in fact, you remember I mentioned Hot Springs Island before. Hey,
yes.
Right. That's an island where a bunch of stuff happened. That's exactly the kind of thing where you've made the decision to put the island part right up front. Or fundamentally, right, a lot of sci-fi games take place on islands, except those islands are planets.
And the ships are ships in space, the sea, and, you know, we like our tropes.
Not even just that, right? When I say those islands are planets, I mean, everything your characters are doing is probably going to be a series of environments on a planet or on a space station or whatever.
But right? Part of the challenge is leaving it at some point.
Right. So I took a look at the Pathfinder universe, and I got to be honest, they got graveyards all over the place. They got abandoned gemstone mines all over the place. They are chock full on mysterious islands. There's basically two flavors of mysterious island available in Pathfinder.
Okay.
There is mysterious jungle island off the coast of what is definitely not Africa, but basically is.
So the approach they took to the setting this time around was analogs.
They have done a lot of novel stuff with it, but it's not hard to pick a big influence for most of the regions that they describe.
Sure.
Okay. The Mwangi Expanse is definitely Africa, and it's not just Africa, but it's sub-Saharan Africa, right?
I see.
Because the nations, like Osirion, is definitely Egypt, okay? And that's at the north end of the continent where the Mwangi Expanse is.
I'm curious, do you think, was it Forgotten Realms or Greyhawk that really set the tone for that as far as these campaign settings go as adaptations of our history?
I think it's inevitable that it happened.
Sure. I mean, it's, to be fair, it was a consistent thing in fantasy long before either of those.
Absolutely. Going back at least as far as Robert Howard, and that's a long way, okay?
Yeah.
Recognizable versions of history are a key part of sword and sorcery fiction, period.
Which was more or less the origin point for a lot of these games.
Right. It is not hard if you spend some time to look at the geography of Hyboria, and it's pretty well documented by a lot of different people, and try to guess what Howard had in mind, because that was how his mind worked. In addition to the fact that, again, it's kind of inevitable to think about a fantasy setting this way. What are these people like is going to lead you back to real world analogs. And then if you are doing any kind of work on it, it's going to lead you to, but also this is going on there.
You know, it reminds me back in my years at grad school, USC. We had more than a few explain to us that the best way to try to pitch anything was, it's like this but that, or it's like this plus that.
Well, it's a very good way to get the ball rolling on a pitch. It's not necessarily where you want to stop.
Well, you see, that was the frustrating part, because fundamentally, it was the easiest entry point. But it oversimplifies significantly and often leaves way too much room for the associated troubles and baggage.
And I want to return to that sort of problem in a minute, right? But the point is, there's a lot of mysterious islands available in Pathfinder. There's no real reason I had to pick one of those. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no real reason you can't have an abandoned gemstone mine anywhere in the Pathfinder universe and so on. And so then, because I had written down for the graveyard that this is not a graveyard that is full of bad guy undead. This is a graveyard full of undead that are guarding something, right? Sure. Which pushes us in a slightly different direction. I mean, sure, you're probably going to fight a bunch of zombies, right? But the fundamental thing is, these zombies are not the bad guys. They're not marauding around the countryside eating brains. They're hanging out in their graveyard, trying to keep anybody from fooling with something.
They're not the servants of some hipster necromancer trying to show you that, you know, white robes and hats are cool again.
Or whatever. Exactly. You know, they're there doing a thing. Okay. The abandoned gemstone mine points in a couple of obvious directions in the context of the Pathfinder setting, mm-hmm. mostly to Cyclopes. There were multiple ancient Cyclops kingdoms in the Pathfinder timeline, and Cyclopses in Pathfinder can see the future.
So what you're saying is that you have full license to just say Cyclopean as much as you want in the writing.
All the time. I can use the word in like every sentence for an entire paragraph if I want of description.
Okay. You need to preface this module with a drinking game as a side option.
Drink every time this word Cyclopean comes up. But I didn't want to do Cyclopes, so I found a weird thing in one of the Pathfinder bestiaries, and I'm going to roll with that. That's fine.
Okay. They kind of seem like scaling little people.
They're a weird sort of, not exactly Medusa, not exactly not. They put me immediately in mind of one of the great old ones, Githanothoa, who is one of those also-ran great old ones.
Okay.
Githanothoa's main deal, in addition to being, you know, an unknowable, sanity-blasting, you know, thing, right, because it's a great old one, is that if you see it, you turn to stone, but your brain stays alive.
Oh, so you're trapped in his presence for all eternity.
It sort of turns people into these like leathery statue mummies, and then but leaves their brains alive, which is horrible.
Yeah.
All right. And these dudes who I have set on from the bestiary reminded me of Githanothoa, because they do more or less the same thing. Like Medusas, they can turn people to stone, but you get better if you are dragged into the sunlight.
I just had a terrible idea.
Hmm.
They don't view this as a punishment. It's a way for you to cultivate your mind.
They probably don't. I'm not sure I really want to go deep into that angle, don't get me wrong, but I think that's a reasonable hypothesis.
Sure.
So those dudes are of a medium challenge level, which obviously pushes the abandoned gemstone mine later into the adventure. And that's fine if this is an arc, you know, like I'm considering this as a series of related.
If your opening episode is Bob gets turned into a statue with his brain still jelly, things have amped.
We are playing a very different game than Pathfinder Second Edition at that point. I can start some games that way.
That sounds more like, the series that the guys who are at Lost are doing now, where they just went straight to humanoid monsters to disembowel folks in episode one.
Oh, I don't know what that is.
I think it's called Found or something, because, you know.
Okay, well, now you've spoiled Found for everybody. Good job. Or whatever the series actually turns out to be.
I could look up, but that would distract me from paying attention to you.
Yes, which would be horrible. Obviously, we can't have that.
Consistency.
So you can't start with those guys. You could start with the cemetery, but low difficulty undead are kind of boring, right? Which makes the cemetery at the earliest episode.
I think the other challenge you kind of run into nowadays is that people have been inured to most of the standard things that these stories would do due to television and movies, et cetera, already running them and video games already running them into the ground.
I don't necessarily look at that as a problem.
It's not a problem per se, but, you know, if it's, oh, zombies, then sure. That's not exciting in and of itself. You have to find the intrigue elsewhere.
Right. What are the zombies doing is the important question at this point. And I'm okay with that.
Question. Mm-hmm. In the societies where this kind of graveyard is residing,
right,
are the undead part of the culture or are they left over from something preceding?
So with one huge glaring exception, within the Pathfinder setting, undead are not supposed to be around. The goddess of death in the Pathfinder setting is super opposed to leaving undead hanging around. And nobody else is particularly excited about it either.
Right. So the fact that these have persisted for as long as they have means either something incredibly powerful or purposeful or both has laid them there.
Honestly, I think it takes us back to they're not bothering anybody as the reason.
So they're guarding a thing that is remote, that is perhaps unknown to most now.
Right. So whatever they're guarding is probably in the middle of nowhere, fairly literally, which takes us away from, for example.
Essentially, it's why not go, why cross that desert? Well, one, it's a desert. Two, it's full of ghouls. Okay, but why are the ghouls there?
Right. Maybe we shouldn't go there.
there's the ancient mausoleum of yada yada over there. And
right.
Who needs to go to that?
So what crossed my mind is that if these guys are guarding something, then the reason why the players are going to be bothering them is that they need that thing.
Sure.
Now, okay.
You have to step back to, okay, what are reasons for why they would need it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, they might have personal ones that they furnish you with, but the premise of the module or the adventure itself should give them something to...
So a thing that occurred to me, right, as I was kind of putting this together and drawing it up, is that it's probably taking place in somewhere where they have a nobility within the Pathfinder setting, which is a lot of it, but not the whole place.
Why are they going for treasure? Someone rich wants it.
Well, not even because somebody rich wants it, although sure, that's a great basic motivation. What do you end up guarding eternally, right? The relics of the people who could do something dangerous with it and who wants those things. Well, obviously adventurers, but also people who are plotting something.
Sure.
Okay?
People who want money, influence, or power.
Right. The easiest possible end to this would be to let one of the players be looking for something that used to belong to one of their ancestors to get the ball rolling on this.
Personal attachment.
Right. And there are some players, but fewer than you'd think, who would be all about that.
Oh, sure. There's the one you could give just the ceremonial tassel to that's been handed down for generations. And when they finally get to the graveyard, all of the zombies wear that.
Right. There are some people who would be in to that idea, but there aren't that many. So you don't want to necessarily assume that premise. Okay. I even think it's a sizable minority of players who would be willing to do that if you talked it through with them in the first place. And one of the nice things about Pathfinder as kind of a development environment or a thinking environment is that for all of the adventure paths, they do a book that is the briefing for the players before you start doing anything. All right. This is probably who your characters are. These are the kind of things you're going to run into. This is where you're starting out.
So naturally, we began with a trash-eating drug peddler.
I don't know if there was anything natural about that, but that was one of those things where I kind of had to just sort of step out of the way of where you guys tend to go with these things. I don't want to talk about that game too much in this episode until more of it, really at all on your show, until more of it happens.
Which is fair. I think the question of what hooks the players in comes down to first figuring out why this thing, this object that these zombies are guarding is meaningful and to who.
Right.
And then who of them wants it now?
Yes. So when I did some more reading on the setting, I settled on probably Taldor as the most likely place to have this, but not Taldor is basically, although not literally, the equivalent of the Roman Empire in the Pathfinder main setting.
Okay.
A long time ago, they ran most of the stuff on this continent on what is the equivalent of the Northern Mediterranean.
So there's a lot of faded glory in their history.
Correct.
There are ruins predating the place as it is now that span into their neighbors and their neighbors' neighbors' territories.
Taldor as a country within the setting goes back something like 4,000 years.
Curious, is this cemetery or this graveyard where the regalia is? Does it reside within Taldor's current borders, or is it outside?
I think it is in Taldor's current borders, and I'll tell you why in a minute.
Okay.
All right, let me get my dating under me just for the heck of it, because it'll make me feel better. It's just how I'm wired. I don't know what to tell you.
You have a degree in digging holes, I'm not going to argue.
Now, there's a timeline offered somewhere in here, and I could swear I had it open still, but it looks like I don't. So, that's a bummer.
You can make it up, we won't know.
Yeah. But the point is, no, Taldor has been around a long time. This is a fact. Even if I'm beefing it on the numbers right now, this is a true fact about the setting of Galarion, okay, and the Inner Sea region. Okay. So basically Taldor used to run everywhere on the Inner Sea from the east end of it to the west end of it on the north side. Okay. But it took that over in stages with what are called the armies of exploration.
That seems kind of euphemistic.
Yes and no. Okay, so Taldor is heir to Aslant, which is not Atlantis, honest we swear, and is definitely not where a bunch of those mysterious islands now.
Well, I'm seeing the beginning of the thread then, because it sounds like whatever the scepter or staff is made out of might have originated in the not Atlantis region.
Sure, or it could even be a more recent, but not that much more recent, development. I haven't really decided yet.
Right. It could be that they're trying to restore the faded glories of a group of people who tried to restore the faded glories of a group of people who...
Just tried to restore the faded... Yeah, this could be basically part of what is basically the study of Taldor, which is that Taldor fell the hell apart. Okay?
So there's a good entry point right there. Whoever wants, or among the people who want the scepter now, are those who wish to make one more go at this.
I think that's probably true. I think that's the most obvious way to go in there. So there were six armies of exploration, okay? And the most successful one was the third. And the first three basically went north rather than west, mm-hmm. Okay? Until the third went west, if I'm looking here. Yeah. So the third army went west along the coast of the Inner Sea, all the way to the west coast of the continent. So obviously, whoever ran off with this relic was part of the first or second army of exploration.
Did either of those two explorations never return or disappear or part of it break off?
No, neither disappeared. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what both did was follow a big dang river north. Mm-hmm. Okay. And one of them followed it about halfway over some big mountains that are full of frost giants and super haunted. Okay. Into the region that is now called the Stolen Lands, which, if you played Kingmaker, is where you are in Kingmaker. Okay. And the other one went up about that far and then made a left.
See, now I'm seeing this kind of moment where you have to negotiate with the giants to let you pass. You can go raid the graveyard of the ancient legions.
If you give me the opportunity to work giants into something, I'm probably going to try to find a way to take it.
Well, see, and I think that's one of those moments of challenge where obviously these things are big and angry and cold and frozen and will annihilate you.
Right.
You know, the challenge isn't about fighting. It's about, you know, finding a way past them.
Right. So what I think this thing is probably from either the first or second army of exploration, from some officer or duke or, you know, whatever it is they have in Taldor. I'll check my facts later. Okay. But they definitely have nobility. All right. Who, like Aaron Burr was threatening to back in the 19th century here in America, went rogue. For those of you who don't know anything about Aaron Burr.
Outside of Hamilton
and that commercial with the peanut butter. Okay. Before he got shot by Alexander Hamilton, or before he had a duel with Alexander Hamilton, I should say, right? In fact, did he win the duel? I'm not necessarily remembering.
Technically, yes.
Okay. Burr was a veteran of the Continental Army, so the Revolutionary War, all right? And after the Revolutionary War, he got elected to various, you know, state assemblies in New York and tried to run for president a couple times and things like that. But eventually he got pissed off because he realized he was never going to be president. Mm-hmm. This is after he had been Jefferson's vice president. It became clear to him that it just wasn't going to happen.
So the best route to ruling at that point is to have your own nation.
So his plan was literally to go over the Alleghenies to Ohio, over to the area of the Mississippi, and basically just set up his own dang country.
Okay, yeah. There's definitely a grave to that guy guarded by one of the legions that the giants are now in the way of.
Right. So what I'm thinking is that in the northern parts of Taldor, mm-hmm. somebody at some point several thousand years ago may have gotten onto a similar plan. This just seems, you know, within the realm of what one might expect to me. That's kind of the overarching theme I have chosen, right? At one point, a long time ago, an ancient general had a cool magical thingy, and now his descendants want it back.
So that they can do the same.
Or for legitimacy in what is an increasingly destabilized and chaotic country, or whatever, right?
Right. I think one of the things you had suggested in the chat was a bastard scion.
Right. So maybe a villain later is somebody else from this family who people don't know about, who is definitely like a real bad dude who's like, you know, if I had the helm of command or whatever it turns out to be that I settle on. Right.
No, let's be honest. It's a big funny hat.
It could be a big silly hat. It could be a cool orb. It could be a standard. It doesn't actually matter yet. Okay.
What if it could be all of those things?
That would be weird. And probably too weird for the Pathfinder setting. It's going to be one thing. I just haven't decided what yet.
My favorite piece of regal attire I gave to a character was a golden scarf that only had the following inscription on it. It said, it helps to keep one's head attached.
Yeah. So, all right, that's kind of our big picture story. So there's a couple ways to look at this. The easiest way to sort of info dump is to make this guy the boss of the graveyard, right?
Obviously, you have to have a monologue from this person at some point because they're the kind of person who'd monologue.
I could have run Taldor so much better, you know, that kind of thing. But they wouldn't let me. They wouldn't let me, so I took my troops and...
You know what you do? This is borrowing from Brian Sanderson's Mistborn. But that guy is gone. The Legion's still there. And all they find are all of his chiseled out monologues to the point where he finally expired. And there's just walls upon walls in the tomb of his constant eternal rambling.
I mean, from my perspective, the most fun thing to do is have all these skeletons and zombie guards.
Sure.
Not have realized the dude left already.
Yes.
And then bring him back later on.
Oh, so he's undead or something eternal and decides to come back. That would be a fun twist if, in fact, one of the funny hat-wearing nobles was the same guy.
Sure, was the same guy, or if his ghost was still haunting some other place trying to, you know, finish up an entirely different or the same nefarious scheme because you don't have all the facts.
Here we go. In the grave, you know, is the scepter. His ghost is stuck in the hat.
You know, I mean, there's worse ideas, man. That's probably not where I'm going to go. I won't lie. But.
Oh, come on. You wouldn't run a game with a haunted hat.
I absolutely would run a game with a haunted hat. I just wouldn't write this setup with a haunted hat in it. Okay. We're trying. So what I was talking about before, when you were talking about how challenges can, you know, get away from you and have too many options. That's too many options. If you're trying to write something that might be for publication or just even to go through the exercise and have a completed product at the end, you mm-hmm. can't let yourself just wander off into the weird unless that's the point of the exercise, which is not here.
Right. You have to set a certain tone for what you want to establish as the narrative and let the party or the players, whomever, do the deviation.
Right.
If that's what they desire.
An important part of running something that runs a long time is verisimilitude is what I was going to say, but I think what I want is actually just consistency. Whatever it is, you have to create something that has rules, has mm-hmm. systems, has themes, so that people can play with them. You can't just throw them out every now and then.
Follow, even if it takes a long time.
Right. So, like, a fundamental issue I got into in Dexter's game, mm-hmm. and I haven't talked to him about this yet, so if he does hear this before we talk, sorry, okay, is that I had written a character who was motivated differently from all of the other players.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a problem.
It can be if it's not something that you all fully comprehend or have discussed.
Right. And that's not to say that nobody tried to work on that with me or anything like that, because that's not true, okay?
Right.
But starting from somewhere different than everybody else and then joining the game later was a real problem.
That does create narrative challenges. It usually establishes.
Yeah, that's an even better way to put it. It was challenging. It wasn't a problem. Okay. And I don't think we entirely finished that or resolved that before he had ended the game, which is too bad. But, you know, not everything pays out.
I ran a game 3.5 years and then we all had to have people go to grad school or move and it never ended.
And that was the end of that. Right.
It would be, we tried a couple times, it's a year or change later, maybe two revisiting it, but it wasn't there anymore.
You know, the momentum and atmosphere were probably both gone by then. And that's just what happens.
Sure.
Sometimes. It's too bad, but it is what happens.
I'd say it's actually part of the reason why, attempting as it is for me to run things nowadays, and I'm far too exhausted to do that, but I'm enjoying letting someone else, Andrew, run our games now, because it helped, you know, I get to have the chance to sit back and step away from the wheel and just be one of the contributing factors to complication instead of the person sitting there and going, okay.
So you've done that. This is what comes of it. There's nothing wrong with that job, but it does get tiring after a while.
No, it is a lot of fun. Otherwise, I wouldn't participate or be a writer.
So if we envision this as like a 4 or 5 part thing, I think 5 is what I want to shoot for.
Right. So okay. Then we know the islands are 4 or somewhere in 3 or 4. They've got to be pretty deep in.
So I think 2 is obviously the graveyard, because that's sort of the, right. And now you know what we're really doing here.
You need a reason to get there, which is 1. Being right. There and what you do is 2.
Right. And then the gemstone mine is 3.
Right, because you discover at the end of this that there is a magnificent gem somewhere.
I think what you find at the end of two is that the thing is missing.
Right. Maybe the piece that is most important, which is part of a gem or whatever, isn't there or broken. Right.
And so you go to the abandoned gemstone mine to make a new one.
Right. Okay. And that's obviously a great idea.
Probably not. Okay.
I'm just suggesting that when things are called abandoned, they almost always are. Right.
Right. Yeah.
There's no gunpowder oozes or weird mole people.
No, never.
Okay. This is me failing my perception check.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, everything here looks completely legit, totally deserted and safe.
It's the same thing as seeing something labeled forbidden on the map. That's the best place to go.
Right. Oh, well, we're going to the Forbidden Temple. I mean, obviously there's some cool shit there. We're not going over there to the extremely safe cove.
Right. We're joking, but part of the fun here is in the nomenclature or the very obvious tags you can pass along to the people playing. If you want to catch attention, do this or describe this.
Right. Which means that part one needs to be how the players distinguish themselves to whoever's family wants this thing.
Right. And we were joking, but there are many ways to go about this. We had talked in the chat about, do they get involved in the raiding of the graveyard? Do they protect the people raiding the graveyard?
Right.
Are they there after to determine who did and why and to figure out what their motive was? There's a number of different avenues you can take to why they go there.
Yeah. So I think basically the first adventure sets up why you're working for this person.
The Grand Empiricist.
The whoever. I know you really want there to be a Grand Empiricist, and that's a different game.
I know. I think there's just going to be someone with a big fancy title. That's my point.
Yes. It may be, you know, Baron or High Marquis or, you know, whatever. Okay. Sure. But somebody's going to have a title at some point, and you need to impress that person by the end of stage one, whatever stage one is. Okay.
Right, because likely they have the means or the information you need to get to this place.
They know about the graveyard in the first place. Okay. Maybe you find out about it, but they know why you should care.
You know, it'd be really helpful for the grand title to be inserted would have something to get you past the giants that you have to keep safe or otherwise intact till you get there.
Sure. You could go that route, and maybe I will. I don't want to try to get quite that detailed yet.
No, I'm just throwing out there's a reason why this person matters for them to engage with and be impressed or otherwise get what they need from somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Thievery, chicanery, or, you know, honest aid.
Honestly, I think the main thing is that we need this person to put them up to going to the graveyard and the gemstone mine. All right. It might turn out by the end of the gemstone mine episode that this person is a bad guy and they have to be stopped.
Well, you know, here's a hook for you. Let's presume the Blades in the Dark Thieves style, you know, characters with the maze, you know. Let's say either they're in the maze or they get out of the maze. If they're in the maze and they can't find any way to get out, maybe the owner of the house is the one who says, tell you what, let's make an arrangement.
Sure.
Because I don't feel like keeping you here forever. It'll make it dirty.
Oh, you're trapped in my maze. I'll let you out if you go get me the dingus of Amogdalo.
Alternately, you escape the maze, and then whoever is a position of authority, Lord Constable Hightower,
arrest
is standing there. Yes,
right.
Arrest you, and then walks in later and either gets superseded by a higher title or says, you know, you're really good, not great, but really good at what you do.
You might be able to help me with something.
Sure.
Right.
And these are very
basic setups, to be clear. Mm-hmm. Like, we know that we're not exactly, you know, batting 1,000 on creativity, but that's kind of the point. You start from...
The goal here isn't to assume that you're going to be giving all of the cards. You're just giving the start.
Right. You start from something that does make sense, because that's the kind of thing that is a prompt for a fantasy story frequently. Okay. Well, then
this goes back to our pacing exercises. If you have to establish a certain amount of the everyday first.
Correct.
The everyday first of what is the thing like normally.
You have to start from a situation that people understand. Then you can start worrying about putting your own spin on it.
Right, because otherwise, you know, it's you wake up in the graveyard, and that's a, like, there's a viable story of you're being buried alive, get out, and, oh, what kind of graveyard are we in?
Yes.
And, oh, it's being robbed, too, and what the hell?
And what is going on here? Oh, no. Right. And these are all things you could do.
Okay, it's there just, we go. Yeah. Here's another avenue. You don't escape the maze. You get knocked out, and you find yourself being buried by the cyborg in the graveyard.
Well, now I have all kinds of questions, but at least you got my attention.
It's a different tone. It's an entirely different tone. But, you know, you could go that route if that was the type of story you wanted to play in.
Right. So I think probably by the end of the third episode, you have discovered this lost heir guy, and maybe he's gotten the better of you.
Right. So you get the graveyard, you go to rebuild it in the mines, and of course, lost Duke Emperor, you know, Talhauer.
You go retrieve the, you know, jade orb of somebody or another so that you can repair the scepter.
Right. And if we're keeping the theme here, let's say, you know, you got arrested, you got pardoned, and now who's waiting for you at the entrance of the mine but the actual undead Duke himself or there himself?
I see you have repaired my scepter. Give it to me, etc.
Yeah, yada yada monologue. Who knows?
Ah, now I can complete my ambitions.
My crystal skull to build my pyramid of...
I feel like this is not really a crystal skulls and pyramids type of thing. This is definitely some, like, extremely classical type of setup, or even...
They want their hat, they want their scepter, they want their coat.
Or even something out of, like, Catholic or medieval iconography. This is more the field we're operating in here. Much as I like crystal skulls and pyramids.
There's a certain fun too where they find themselves throughout the journey recreating the path of the expeditions.
Yes. So I think the first thing the thing that leads to the graveyard is the travelogue of this guy who may actually turn up as a villain later.
Well, and that could be a fun thing too. It could just be a mundane travelogue full of this person's musings and recollections.
And observations and frustrations and things like that.
You can play that out. Frost giant sheep are tasty, but don't steal them.
I feel like we don't necessarily need to even involve the giants here yet.
Sure.
Right? This guy has decided, well, we went up the cell and everything was great. I'm going to go up toward the fog peaks and make my own situation.
Makes no mention of the giants whatsoever.
Doesn't even, you know, they say there are giants here, but, you know, I bet I can take them with my troops. We're seasoned veterans and things like that.
Right. And then you talk about the bitter cold, the horrible storms, et cetera. We all survived and move on.
You can go full ravenous or full the terror by the end of this if you really wanted to.
Okay. This guy is absolutely Robert Carlyle.
I feel like no, as much fun as that would be for me. Again, we're trying to stay within the realm of the regular. No, I think what happens probably leading into the fourth episode, right, is that it becomes clear that the reason why the replica is not working is the original actually is still out there somewhere.
It was stolen before.
And the replica can help you find it.
Sure. It could be, Indiana Jones 2, where they had to create the pole to get the light to shine the...
With the staff and the medallion Temple of Doom. Right, something like that.
What are the MacGuffins to get the MacGuffins to get the door open?
Right. It can be something like that.
Mm-hmm. And it could also be that maybe each of the legions, unbeknownst to the other, was trying to find one portion of this without being told that.
Sure. So I think what happens then is the new one leads to the old one, is kind of the...
Right, then you end up on the path of Legion 2 or 3, and... their adventures.
And then you have both. So now you have two scepters.
Right, but Duke Talhauser is already on the lead toward the Isles of Infinity.
And now you have to go do something with them, yes.
Right, and that's what takes you to the islands, because the something you have to do is at a place you can't get to.
Yes, I think that makes sense.
Right, so then it's get means of transport there, however you do.
Right, I think...
And that could be an act itself.
Yeah, I think ultimately the players should find themselves going north.
Curious. Do you think we should have somewhere like Act 3, let's say, a race against the transportation methods of Grand Evil Duke Wizard Talhauser and the Armada of Yore?
Well, I think it depends on what you decide makes the most sense to drive this, right? Like, if I was feeding it to you guys, I know you're not going to bite on an NPC as a rival unless they are terrible.
Unless we hate them, sure.
Right. Not only unless you hate them, but unless you, like, really have a genuine dislike for this NPC for one reason or another, which means I'm going to have him jump you on the way out of the graveyard or something else terrible. The point is, he's going to have to be introduced really early, do something despicable immediately, and get away somehow.
Well, and I think this is an interesting point to question the module, because that is a very group-specific design.
Right. I don't think everybody needs that.
It might, in fact, be even that one of the challenges in a very different story is that you wonder if, in fact, your rival has noble intentions.
Yes.
Even if their means are questionable, or you're not sure what the outcome of said intentions will be.
Right. So a large part of the adventure path that they wrote a long time ago, dealing with the world wound and this demonic invasion that has been in process for a long time in the setting, that by the release of second edition is actually resolved, Wrath of the Righteous. Okay.
Was that what they did at the game, the second game, they released keys into the new launch?
Well, in Pathfinder 2nd Edition, the outcome of at least some of their better adventure paths is apparent, okay, from the text about the setting. I can tell you that Iron Gods had multiple possible outcomes, and this was a Pathfinder 1st Edition adventure path that was awesome because it had barbarians and robots.
This is not like where they tried to get rid of Vecna and Greyhawk by giving him the keys to Sigil and Planescape?
It's a lot smaller scale. But if you read the text about the region where that happens, Numeria, all right, in the 2nd Edition rulebook, it is clear which ending of Iron Gods happened. Okay? It is clear from the fact that there is no World Wound anymore, some version of which ending of Wrath of the Righteous happened.
Things got better. It's kind of hard to have certain stories when there's just a constant stream of monstrosities pouring into the world.
Right. It is clear that Grand Princess Eutropia, okay, won the power struggle that was detailed in another one of the adventure paths in 1st Edition from the 2nd Edition text.
Considering she's still there and in charge.
Right. She's in charge of Tal'Dorei now. It used to be her dad. Okay. And there's a whole adventure path. I think it's called War for the Crown, fairly, you know, predictably dealing with that.
This might even be an interesting kind of subtext that you start weaving into maybe part two or part three. I imagine, I don't know much of her narrative or arc, but maybe there's a certain amount of her nobility vying for influence, et cetera, that she's willing to overlook because it keeps them busy with each other.
Well, basically, that she is described as a modernizer, right?
Okay.
And so, since the region of Tal'Dorei want to use is the northern, extremely remote part of it, I think the goal of the good guy who gets the ball rolling on this is actually to impress her.
Well, not just that, but I think she's going to be relatively inactive, or not inactive, but distant from this until it's readily apparent that should this stuff come to pass, I'm going to have a major rival for
rulership. There's going to be a problem. Right, right, exactly.
So at some point, the official rulership, governance, spies, etc., in her employ get involved.
Yes, probably around step 4 or 5 here. If this is 5 steps long.
By the time you're trying to get to the island to do the ritual, etc., yeah.
Yeah, probably before that, even. I would guess they get involved in part 4.
Right. Once you get out of the mines.
She hears that you've made a new Jade Scepter.
And is troubled.
And some of her guys show up and are like, so what are you going to do with the Jade Scepter, guys?
Like, that's another thing, too. You could get out of the mines and find there's already an ensuing melee between Duke Duke Wizard Hightower and the forces.
I like Duke Hightower. That's just a good name.
They have those kinds of names. It's the kind of names they would give themselves.
A good story can excite us, yes. But the best ones, fiction or not, compel, inspire, or drive us toward the hope that we need for a better life. Remember, you don't need to know everything right now, but you do need to write. So make sure to like, review, and subscribe to us at Here Be Tigers. And until next time, take life by the tail.